This is the Happy Dev Podcast with me, James Brooks, and my co-host, John Wiles. Hey, hey, welcome back to season two of Happy Dev, episode two. In this episode, I'm interviewing my co-host, John Wiles. We get to learn about John, his history with mental health, and what the future holds for him. Now, just before we get into the episode, I want to say that season two is shaping up to be really good. We have some amazing guests coming on, and they're all excited to share their experience. Anyway, for now, let's speak to John. Good morning, John. How are you doing?
I am not too bad, thanks. Today feels like one of those days where I've managed to pack just about every facet of life into one day. So quite a lot to do with the kids, quite a lot to do with work, volunteering stuff. But yeah, those days are quite nice. They whiz by at least.
Do you find that your schedule gets busier and busier as the year goes on, or even in reverse as well? Does it get easier through the end of the year?
I think things do tend to sort of speed up a little bit through spring and summer, and then I don't know, autumn can sometimes just feel like a bit of a grind, I think at the moment it's just I've kind of taken on a lot of new stuff, and it's trying to find its way into like the various slots of the week that I can do it all in. But it's good.
It's hard when a lot of it's not paid as well. Like you've got the paid stuff always has to kind of be the foundation, hasn't it?
It does. And it's difficult sometimes when the other stuff is perhaps a tiny bit more interesting than the paid stuff. Or at least it's kind of more novel and new, and you want to kind of really jump into it with both feet. But yeah, you have to kind of keep remembering to put food on the table and stuff like that.
Your kids and wife have to eat, John.
Exactly. I know. It's so selfish like that.
So if you haven't listened to the first episode yet, John is our new co-host for Happy Dev season two. It has been a while since we recorded the first episode. Today at the time of recording is the 6th of March. We did actually record the first episode in like the first week of January, maybe even the second. But we've both been very busy, so editing and releasing has taken a bit more time than we anticipated, largely down to me. I had laser eye surgery at the start of the year and was kind of blind for a few days, and then conferencing. So hopefully we're getting back onto that kind of release cycle. So shall we jump straight into it?
I think we should.
Okay. Yeah. So can you start by telling us about your first experience with mental health? When did you first realize that maybe you weren't feeling yourself?
And I was actually thinking about this the other day. Relatively recently, I would say, but in hindsight, it probably goes back a lot further. So basically, I think I realized about 3 years ago, I think it was mid tail end of the pandemic, that something wasn't quite right. And it's almost like the pandemic shook it loose. But I think that stuff had been going along for a very long time. I'd just been ignoring it and sort of increasingly feeling and running on empty for a long time. And I think it was probably when the lockdowns sort of eased and stopped. And well, actually going back a step, when the pandemic started, it was almost like the whole world kind of ground to a halt in certain ways, at least certainly did kind of for me and the sort of people around me. You know, everyone was sort of locked down, everyone was at home. Mm-hmm. And honestly, I know it was a terrible time for a lot of people. People lost loved ones. And so I don't want to sort of misrepresent how this comes across. But for me, it felt like the entire world had slowed down to my pace, if that makes sense. Yeah. And I didn't feel like I was missing out on life. I didn't feel like I was sort of living a half life or whatever, because it felt like everyone was doing that. And for the first time in forever, it felt like everything had slowed down to how life felt for me. Mm-hmm. So in a lot of ways, I really enjoyed those lockdowns because it felt like, oh, such a relief. You know, I'm not missing out on anything. There's nothing to feel like I'm losing out on. But when things started opening up and life started getting back to normal, it kind of felt like almost like someone had pressed fast forward on everything else and I was still stuck.
Yeah.
And I think at that point I realized something's not right here. And But, you know, 3 years later, you know, 3 years of fairly expensive therapy later, and I can kind of like see in hindsight, I wasn't right for a very long time, like in the run up to that, like probably most of my life, you know.
So do you think that you had maybe been depressed for that time or something, and that's why it felt like you were unaligned from life, I guess?
I think I was. I think that had sort of fluctuated through life. I think I'd had spells of... I think the trouble is, I think I'd been very good at suppressing emotion to the point where... The irony was that I actually felt pretty much like, oh, I'm on a pretty even keel all the time. You know, I don't get hugely sad. I don't get very upset by things that would upset other people. But I almost didn't notice that I also didn't enjoy life.
Yeah.
Like, really connect with anything, or, you know, very little gave me actual joy. I remember even having a conversation with my wife about it. We were out on some walk on a beautiful sunny day, and she was sort of saying, oh, I feel like I'm on like an 8 or 9 out of 10 today. I was like, oh, that's nice. I feel all right. I feel maybe a 6 today, you know. Like, my band was between 4 and 6, you know. I never got down, never felt like I got down to a 1 or 2, and I never felt like I got to a 9 or a 10. And then I realized, oh, I've been like that forever.
Yeah.
You know,
that's a very like telltale sign of depression, that, isn't it? Where you don't, a lot of people think that it's just like extreme sadness or like flip flopping between one extreme to the other. But for many people, at least the people I've spoken to, and in even my own experience at times, it's just the feeling of meh. I'm neither plus.
It's almost an absence.
Yeah. It's an absence
rather than
of
a presence of something.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's sort of, I mean, funny might be the wrong word, but sort of funny to think back on it and to think that I felt that that was like a good thing, you know, for such a long time that, oh, I'm fine, you know, everything's fine. Nothing, you know, like dog in the burning house, you know, everything's fine. But I wasn't, and I don't think I had been for a long time. And it's sort of come and gone through life. And, you know, I had a good spell in my 20s where I was in a really lovely kind of house share with some people that I'm still really close friends with. And I think that period in my life felt pretty good. But then we moved to Bristol, you know, the kids were still very little. And I think that's probably where it really started to slide, because I found it very hard to make friends as a, you know, an adult with young kids.
Yeah.
You think it's going to be easy. And it's not so much that you struggle to make acquaintances. That's relatively straightforward, but to make real
like playground
close friends,
parent friends,
you say hello to you, but you never really get much beyond that. And I think I got very isolated when we moved here, and it really started to take a toll. And like I say, then the pandemic came along and sort of shook everything loose. I realized I had to do something about it, and then looking back in the rearview mirror, I can kind of sort of see the landscape a lot more clearly than I could at the time.
So when did you move to Bristol then? Was that just before the pandemic?
That would have been 2016,
okay.
I think. It was the same year that everything kind of felt like it was going
also
wrong.
Felt, you know, wrong.
Trump
then
was
as
elected,
well.
Brexit. And like, I remember we moved here and everything was really great for a couple of months. And then like, it felt like the world got sort of slightly turned upside down with all of that stuff.
It does feel like a turning point in history, that like things weren't great anyway, were they? Let's be honest. But that moment, I remember thinking like the exchange rate had gone down, Brexit was happening, and I was like, oh God, this is the end of everything. Back to the stage.
No, we struggled on, got through a pandemic after that.
True. So. Resilient.
Being consciously aware of my mental health probably the last 3 years, but then looking back, you know, it's something that's been with me for a long time, I think. And
on the subject of kind of close friends when you move, did you at the time, and do you now have any hobbies where you kind of meet other people?
To be honest, no. And I think this is probably due to a certain way of being that I've had throughout my whole life. I tend to sort of gravitate towards fairly insular kind of hobbies, you know, all the things that I'm interested in don't really involve another person.
Yeah.
You know? So like I play the piano or I do some DIY and, you know, build things with wood and stuff like that. It often doesn't tend to involve anyone else. Where I have found some success in meeting people is like through voluntary work. So in Bristol here, I volunteer at the Wood Recycling Project.
Yeah.
when things aren't too busy, like, you know, maybe once a week for half a day or a full day, I'll go down and, you know, heft pallets around and build things with scaffold boards and stuff like that. And dude, they are such a lovely bunch there. Really, really friendly crew who work there. And then more recently, I've started working on like a mental health support line, volunteering at a mental health peer support group as a facilitator. The trouble with those things is that as a volunteer, you're kind of there to do a job, and it's sort of, you do get to know people and you sometimes get to know them fairly well, but it's less purely about a social connection and more of about shared purpose or
you're
task.
There you're there to fulfill a role for them. Yeah.
Yeah. And that does actually feel easier for me. I find I struggle more where I have to go into a situation where I'm just being me, you know, like I almost have to be useful in some way to feel more comfortable going into a situation like that. So these days I have so much more connection through those things, that sort of intense feeling of loneliness and isolation isn't there anymore. Yeah. But I still feel a bit sad about the fact that I haven't got a group of friends in Bristol that are just friends because I'm friends with them and for no other reason. I mean, there are a couple of people like family friends, but the trouble is most of my friendships are sort of through the rest of the family. I can't think of more than a couple of people in Bristol that I would go and meet up with just by myself. Yeah. You know, it's usually
I do think
as a family.
Maybe I'm being like, I don't know how to phrase this without maybe coming across wrong, but I do think that men in general have a harder time maintaining and creating friendships on their own than women. Like a lot of, so there's a group of friends that I have. There's four lads, and their wives are friends with my wife, and that's how I know them. But I would call them my like three closest friends. And then my friendships, I really only have one or two, one from school when I was like 4 years old. He was my best man. I'm about to be his best man. We've known each other. He was like my first memory of school. And then I've got like other friends that I've like had throughout college or friends of friends kind of thing, but I don't really speak to them very often. But yeah, making my own friends now, I wouldn't, if I'm honest, I wouldn't even know how to begin. and I have like friends in the like Laravel and PHP community development in general. And I'm lucky enough that I now get to work with some of them. But yeah, actual like friends that I see in person and would call up if I had a problem, very few.
Yeah, I think there's something in that. I mean, obviously, we're talking in very broad generalities, you know, when we're talking about sort of, you know, all men or all women.
But yeah, I don't want to kind of use that
really
thing.
Yeah, we're not. But I think there might be something in that. I think for me, like quite often, a lot of the people that I meet who I really do want to be kind of friends with tend to be like, probably almost more women than men, to be honest. And so there's like almost, with that, there's almost like an extra layer of kind of like, well, like I can't just say, do you want to go out for a coffee? Because, you know, you might be sending out some signals that aren't actually intended or meant to be there. So it can be particularly hard when you run into those situations, I think.
Yeah, there's like a stigma probably around that that's like marital and societal as well. Like I'm not, it's a complicated system, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And I think as far as sort of if, you know, if I meet another man that I kind of think, oh, he seems really cool, I, you know, I'd like to sort of hang out with him more often, there is that sort of awkwardness, I think. I think maybe because, you know, and I think things are changing gradually, but I think there's that sort of awkwardness of men, certainly in our society and traditionally, finding it quite hard to express emotion and being able to just be kind of relatively honest about how they feel without having to sort of put on some sort of brave face or kind of almost laughing it off in a way, you know, and sort of I think you're right, there probably is, I mean And as well, I know that this is, again, a huge generalization, but I know that my wife made friends more easily in Bristol, much more easily in Bristol than I did. But that's in part because some of that stuff involved kids and, you know, sort of play dates with kids and then getting to know mums through kids.
School parties. And
obviously, there's no reason why I couldn't have been involved in that, but I always felt slightly awkward in those sorts of things, especially when you're like maybe the only dad in a room full of mums, you know, you kind of feel a bit clunky and out of place and it's harder to.
So, you feel very out of place. I've also done that. I've done like groups with both kids and just being the only dad and I'm trying to like, I don't know, sing a song and I can't sing. I'm obviously like a deeper voice.
You've got the only broken voice in the room. Yeah, the only bass voice.
It's like, well, he can't sing and he like, and I'm just out. I feel awkward. I look awkward.
Yeah.
That was actually going to be one of my points on the kind of generalization I made there, that that women with kids are often at groups or doing the school runs. And like I do the school run as well, and I know plenty of dads that do, but often it's like a school run and run. We don't, I don't know, because it's at least in the school that my kid goes to, there's just a lot of mums doing it and the dads are just like running. They don't want to speak to anyone. Whereas the mums are stopping and having a chat. Again, I'm generalizing there, but it is more often than not, it is that way. And I think that's because they know each other from groups or from school. I didn't grow up in this area either. So that kind of, my wife knows a lot more people anyway.
Yeah, I've noticed this, a similar sort of thing as well. And also there's an element of the kind of, like particularly with school runs and things like that, it's not kind of quality time you're spending, because generally 9 times out of 10, you're going to be interrupted every 3 sentences by a child wanting to tell you something. The whole atmosphere is quite rushed, you know, you don't, and it's very hard to get past sort of pleasantries and, you know, the sort of small talk. It's almost like there's a threshold that you never get beyond to get to the point where you say, oh, this was really fun. Like, do you want to, you know, hang out for a coffee or whatever? It doesn't. Yeah, it's hard to get to the point, you know, hard to get through the small talk part to get to a point where you actually feel like, I feel confident that this person would probably give me a thumbs up if we wanted to hang out at some other some other point.
Have you watched, with you saying that your kids are a bit older now, probably not, but have you watched Bluey?
I don't think so. I've heard of it, but I don't think I've seen it.
I love the smile then. Like, there is an episode, I think it's called Cafes or something, and basically the premise of the episode is that Bluey gets taken to the park by her dad. They're sat playing, and then this other girl comes along with her dad, and the dads sit at the opposite ends of the park, like not acknowledging each other. And then each morning they go back to the park and like the other kid comes as well. And then eventually the kids get their dads involved in the game. They're having a great time. And then they are almost sad when it ends as well. Yeah. And Blue is like, oh, can they come for breakfast? And the dads look at each other really awkwardly, like, well, that's not how this works. Yeah. Whereas the kids are like, let's go. And then the next day they kind of like, they cross that threshold and he's like, oh, we're going to go home for breakfast. Do you want to join us? And they like go home. And it's funny as a dad watching that, because I've never crossed that threshold in the park, but I have seen the same dad and whatever.
It sounds quite well observed.
Okay. So moving on from that then, what is it that you find stresses you the most or kind of triggers you into that state of depression or anxiety?
Yeah, I've become very aware that I conduct myself a lot based around a fear of making other people angry. So like I'll be on the lookout for even the slightest little sort of, you know, twitch in someone's face or, you know, sort of hypervigilant for it kind of thing. Yeah. And what stresses me out is when I feel as though I have in some way inconvenienced someone, angered someone, been a burden for someone. Yeah. And I often find, like, you know, starting a new job for a new client, you know, that can be quite a stressful time because you don't quite know where you stand initially. And you're trying to find that level of like, okay, oh, I know if I work this hard, everything's fine. But then, like, even then, I'm kind of always worried if I have a week where I'm not quite on it, or, you know, if I'm not really firing on all cylinders and the work's not being produced quickly enough, I can almost feel the tension rising, even though they might not have said a single word, even though at the end of that week, they might be going, oh, this is great work this week. You know, it's almost like it doesn't matter. For me, it's an internal barometer that I can feel rising, you know, as I feel like I'm not doing enough or I'm not.
Do you think that's more your own expectations than anything?
Oh, yeah. None of this in, you know, certainly in adult life is based on the actual reactions that I've had from other people, which are, I mean, I'm not universally positive, obviously, but like the number of times that I've actually run into a situation where I've really pissed someone off are like very small. Like, I work so hard to avoid it that, I don't know, it's like chicken and egg. I don't know. But yes, it's very much based on a sort of a template that I've carried through life, kind of expecting those things and working very hard to mitigate them before they've even happened, before they even have a chance to happen quite often. That's actually one of the things that I've noticed more recently. It's almost like I'm overcorrecting often, which can sometimes, ironically, particularly with, for example, my wife, you know, constantly sort of, I don't do it so much now, but I used to sort of, you know, oh, are you okay? Are you feeling all right? You seem a little stressed. Are you okay? You know, almost like, sort of goading her into it, almost. It's like, no, I wasn't, but I am now, you know. Yeah. So,
ironically, I'm in the complete opposite effect.
Yeah.
Wait, is there something wrong? Should I be wrong?
Yeah, pretty much. I'm more aware of that these days, but that is probably the biggest thing that stresses me out. It's not being busy or like life being hectic. You know, I'm not the best at sort of self-organization, but when it comes down to it, I can get through that stuff. You know, I don't mind periods where I have to work quite hard or I have to sort of burn the candle at both ends a little bit, but it's sort of that sort of fear or expectation of an angry response or a disappointed response. Or
Do you think that's like a learnt behavior?
I mean, like everyone, you know, you develop templates through life and then you sort of carry those templates into new relationships and new sort of connections with other people. And you can often do it without even realizing it. It was completely unknown to me until the last few years when I started sort of digging into it every week and, you know, figuring it out. You can go through an entire lifetime not realizing the sort of patterns that you bring into everything. So whilst I wouldn't claim to have all of that sorted by any means, like just being aware of it can be incredibly helpful. You can kind of almost, not every time, but sometimes at least catch yourself and go, is this like a real thing, or is this just my sort of template version of how this is going that I'm listening to? So
sometimes I find myself reacting to something that happens in life, like the kids do something and I react in a way where I'm like, that's learnt behavior as opposed to how I actually want to react. And like in that moment I'm thinking like, everything is telling me, what are you saying? What are you doing? That makes no sense. And then just taking that like deep breath and just starting fresh.
It's hard with a template response to something, you know, it's like cookie cutter. You just do it sort of instinctively and it can be very, very hard to do anything else. I mean, sometimes it's so ingrained, it feels like it's sort of etched in stone inside you, some of those responses you have to people or just your ways of relating to other people.
No matter how wrong it feels inside, your body is like on autopilot.
Yeah. You often notice it after you've done or said something and you're kind of like feeling regretful or, you know, maybe because... And sometimes it will go the other way. You know, sometimes it won't be like an angry response, for example. Yeah. Like someone does something to you that you don't like and you let that boundary completely slip and you capitulate to it or whatever. And then afterwards you're feeling kind of like, ugh, why did I say yes to that thing? Or why didn't I push back on that thing? You know, and it's very easy for that to then become internalized and sort of it's self-attack as well. And then that's when you start feeling huge amounts of anxiety around things. And it's very difficult to break those templates, but just being aware of them in the first instance can be very, very helpful.
So as somebody that is kind of looking to change career into that way, have you got any advice for people that do want to break those templates or recreate them?
I would feel very...
I don't know if that's something you've kind of able to speak about.
Probably not. Okay. Certainly not advice. I don't think that would be... Right for me to be sort of dishing out advice at this stage, because I haven't even got onto one of the training courses yet. I'm just interested in it. And I've been reading about it and sort of doing my own therapy and learning about things through there.
Hang on, we need to put a disclaimer that John's advice is not.
I'm not a therapist. I don't know what I'm talking about. So just take all of this with a pinch of salt. From my experience, I can only speak to my experience. The thing that has helped me hugely is finding someone that I can talk to who will listen without judgment and who will... The thing with therapy almost is it kind of slows things down to the point where you can actually start to spot them. And the issues you've been having in relationships with other people that have brought you to therapy will often get acted out in therapy with the therapist. And it's almost like this little sort of petri dish that you can kind of look into and sort of see, oh yeah, the way that I've just spoken to you there, or the way that I feel about you here and now, is actually quite similar to the way I felt about this person or this person, or the problems I had with that person. It's not a quick process. Well, certainly from my experience, it can, depending on how well defended you are against those sorts of feelings and how well guarded that little set of templates are, it can take quite a long time to strip those defenses away. For me, certainly initially, there was a lot of intellectualizing and sort of trying to look at it all from a very logical, cognitive point of view. And it took a long time, like probably a year, before I started to actually really feel things in therapy and sort of for that to sort of come up. So
it's good that you stuck to that, because I know a lot of people go to therapy, maybe do a few weeks, a couple of months or something, and then just think, well, I don't really feel like I've identified some things. Great. Yeah. I'll stop doing that.
I think there's much more awareness of mental health now, and probably more acceptance of the idea of people going to therapy and a lot less stigma around that. But I think there's probably still quite a lot of misunderstandings. I think the word therapy gets used as sort of an umbrella term for quite a lot of different things. Yeah. So those sort of short term, if you went for, if you did like cognitive behavioral therapy for 5 weeks, 10 weeks or whatever, that might be very useful for some people. And it really might help them to almost address the way that they behave in response to certain thoughts. It's unlikely, though, in 10 weeks, in fact, almost, I would say, probably almost impossible in 10 weeks, that you will be able to uncover and do the work to actually change the underlying things that cause those behaviors. You might find that you get some useful approaches to dealing with them in the sort of symptoms, if you like, in the moment, but you're unlikely to create lasting psychological change through something like that. Whereas something like, longer term psychodynamic therapy, that's where you're doing the work to kind of uncover those really deeply embedded patterns and the reasons for them. And it's less to do with, here's an exercise, a breathing exercise you can do next time you're feeling anxious. It's more like, here's why you behave the way that you do. And here's all the ways that it manifests. It's rarely that kind of, concrete in a session.
But
And that's why I kind of sometimes feel a little bit apprehensive about this new wave of people talking about turning therapy into sort of an AI chatbot.
I think that's a terrible idea, by the way.
I think it makes me shudder to think that there's going to be, to be honest, it's less to do with, I tell you what it is, it's the people who are building them think that it's a good idea. Either they think it's a good idea or they're out to make a quick buck.
If they're the same person, then I think it's to make some money.
Maybe. Well, if it's to make a quick buck, then I'll leave everyone else to make their own conclusions on that one. If it's because they think it's a good idea, then they just don't understand what therapy is,
Yeah.
Therapy is, you come to therapy because there is something fundamentally not working for you in the way that you relate to other people. And the only way you're going to fix that is through a relationship with another person, a new person, the therapist in this case. And that therapist can become a container for all of those sort of maladapted ways of relating to people. And you kind of work it through in relation with a new person.
The thing
there is no person to do that with an AI.
Right. And that AI isn't going to know the questions to ask you that will help you uncover yourself. Like the way that you, I mean, even just doing it like we're on a video chat now. When I mentioned blue, I could see that you smiled and I can see the response that you had to that question, for instance. And AI isn't going to do that anytime soon. And even if it did, it's not going to pick up on those like micro expressions that we as humans know, or like that sense of feeling uncomfortable about something.
I can see why people find them attractive as an idea, because it's almost like a quick fix.
Yeah. You know, and like, ironically, there is no human.
It will be because the attraction is, there's no human that I have to sort of tell all of these sort of like uncomfortable, painful things to.
Yeah.
But you're not going to get better. Maybe they might be useful for some very, you know, basic, I don't know, like potentially useful for things like life coaching or, you know, some of those more manualized CBT type things where it's like, okay, try this exercise next time you're feeling anxious. And maybe that'll help a little bit.
Yeah.
But what I'm worried about is there'll be a whole wave of people who think that they've had therapy and they talk to one of these and they feel worse.
Yeah.
You know, they feel it has the opposite effect to the one that they want. And then they write off their actual therapy as a result. I've tried therapy. I tried it with an AI. Well, no, you didn't.
Yeah.
You spoke to ChatGPT for 10 minutes. Yeah, it's not the same thing at all.
Yeah. I mean, I don't want to kind of dump on AI at all, but it really doesn't feel like the right tool for the job.
There's so many other useful applications for it.
Yeah.
I just feel like this isn't one of them. At least it's not one of them yet, and it probably won't be, I wouldn't have thought, in our lifetimes.
No.
I mean, maybe one day there'll be some sort of, you know, AI in a, you know, robot skin suit or something, and maybe that will be able to do, they will be able to build the perfect therapist. But even then, like, the whole point is that you're a human being who's struggling to relate to other human beings in some way, or yourself. You know, you won't get that from a machine.
Yeah.
It's part of the reason why I wanted to switch careers in the first place. You know, I've spent 16 years staring at a screen and it's taken a toll.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's taken a toll. And I've chosen to work for myself. I've chosen to work remotely. I've chosen to work in a profession where I spend the vast majority of my day staring at a computer screen, and that will work for some people, and it has worked for me pretty well-ish up to a point. I think looking back, maybe it wasn't the best thing for me in some cases, but yeah, I need something different. I need something new. I need something where I'm actively forming fairly deep connections with other human beings. Yeah. I'm almost kind of pivoting way the other way, but you know,
from glass to person. Yeah,
yeah, exactly.
So kind of when you are feeling maybe something's wrong or even general, or even to maintain everything being okay, what do you do to kind of decompress and to be away from the screen?
So I'm not particularly great at self-care, and it is one of those things that I need to work on. I can kind of do the basics. Like I will go for a run a couple of times a week, and, you know, I'll try and do sort of like a 15 minute HIIT workout or something like that. I don't find that exercise gives me some sort of like big high or anything like that, but it will almost sort of set the dial back to sort of neutral almost. And last year I had a few spells of quite severe depression. And what I found was that getting out for a run was almost, it wasn't really anything to do with the exercise. It wasn't anything to do with the run. It was almost just a feeling of actually being in motion, you know, like not feeling completely rooted to the spot, stuck. And if I could just get, I can't remember where I heard it from. I think there might be a psychologist on Twitter that I follow who coined this term, but it's the idea of activation energy. You have the energy to go for a run. That's not really the problem. The issue is you don't have the activation energy to put the shoes on and actually get out the door, you know?
That's a good phrase.
And I really struggled with that last year. But I did find that when I wrote myself, like I'm actually looking at it right now, but like there's a sort of a calendar that I wrote in, it would have been August last year when I was at, probably at my worst, where I literally wrote every single day, I have to do some kind of, I have to plan my day, do some kind of like mobility, like Pilates or something like that.
Yeah.
Do some sort of exercise. And what was the other thing? I'll do some headspace as well. And I had to sort of set myself that every single day, I have to tick all of those things off. It was time consuming to say the least, yeah, to get all of that in every day, but it did help. And the activation energy, if you like, to actually create that plan and then sticking with it wasn't so hard, but actually kind of like literally firing up Excel, creating this little thing to print up on the wall, you know, that might've taken me like 3 weeks.
Yeah.
You know, I was in that kind of place. Outside of that though, an exercise, I find that quite helpful. What I am quite bad at though is making time for hobbies without feeling guilty about taking that time. So it's hard for me to do things and just enjoy the process of doing them. But outside of that, you know, I think I mentioned earlier, like I play piano, I do woodwork. I quite enjoy like having, I usually have like two or three projects on the go that like remain a third to a half finished. And
it's the software developer in you.
Yeah, yeah. Always good to have an unfinished side project. And then I go through spells as well. I'm going through one at the moment where like I'll kick off like a side project and that will become kind of all consuming for a little bit.
Is that kind of the excitement of the project? Like, I'm excited. I've got these things to build. I've got these decisions to think about. And yeah, then you actually get to like the last 5%, which is like another 95%.
Yeah.
Yes. That kind of thing? Or?
There is a bit of that. I've finished a few of them. Like I finished one recently. It's called Impostable, which hopefully by the time this goes out will be more in a slightly more polished state. But basically it's a sort of help with imposter syndrome. Basically it's a little place where you can note down your, note down kind of the good positive things people say about you. Because quite often, like if someone says something positive to me, I'm more aware of it these days, but like certainly in the past, I would have brushed it off. Oh, well, yeah, but that thing over there wasn't very good. Or like I'll negate it in some way. I'll try and find any way I can to sort of minimize the compliment. And one of the helpful ways around that is to start making a note of those things. So I built this little app where you can kind of put those things. If you're not really ready to kind of internalize them now, you can just put them there. And then I haven't built this bit yet, but in time it'll maybe like email you like occasionally, or there'll be like tools for things like Raycast and Slack and stuff. So if you're feeling in the need for a little boost, you can kind of ping the app and it'll give you kind of one of the nice things people said about you. And
even,
yes, sort of like that. Yeah. Yeah.
I like
that's the
that.
Idea.
Yeah.
But the idea is that not to sort of like swell your ego or anything. I think people who struggle with imposter syndrome actually have almost the opposite problem. It's more so that over time you can kind of almost come to internalize those things. Not the specific words maybe, but just the general feeling of like, oh, okay, you know what? I'm telling myself that I'm no good at this thing, but I've got all of this evidence to the contrary. So, okay, well, maybe I still feel that, but maybe it's not true. And then over time, maybe that can shift more into, you know what? I can do this. You know, I am okay at this.
I like that as well, because it takes the emphasis on the negative. I don't know if you're the same, but for me, the positive stuff just kind of brushes off. It's like a very, oh, thanks. And then I'm like, I'll forget about it. And, but all the negative stuff, if somebody's like, you can't do that, I'm like, well, I'll show you. Like,
yeah,
I will do that. Or it will, or it's like, oh, James was really bad at that. And I'd be like, that would just eat away at me. Even though it could just be one against 100 comments, like that negative thing is what will sit with me more than the positives.
That's the one you cling to. It's interesting to hear you say you have sometimes have that reaction of like, that almost kind of screw you reaction. Like, I'm gonna show you. I have that exact same thing as well. Like if there's even a hint of criticism, sometimes I'll like double down, you know, I'll sort of, you know, burn my own fuse quite a lot just to show you like, oh, I can do this, you know, like overachieve.
Which isn't
almost.
Isn't a good thing really, because you can go too far with that like work too hard on something or spend too much time thinking about it, and it's not a healthy thing to do, unfortunately. Even though it could end up with the result that you actually want, the process of getting there is not always the best.
Exactly, yeah. Unhealthy is probably the word. You end up putting way too much of your effort and time and energy. I suppose, that's it. You're burning your own energy to kind of almost over-correct something that was just maybe a really minor thing. Yeah, yeah, really minor. And you just, you take it to heart and then you have to, double down on it. But yeah.
Yeah. That's cool. We will hopefully, by the time this this goes live, we can get Impostable in the show notes.
Yeah. Technically it's live as we speak. Okay. It's just that there's a few things in it that I know could be done a bit better. So I'm kind
MVP,
of...
MVP, ship it.
Yeah, well, it's been shipped. It's just... Yeah, and there's like a little thing in there that people can kind of vote on, like which extension they want me to build first, like whether it's Raycast or Slack or a browser extension, I think is the other one. So anyone's interested, take a little look and let me know what you want to see in there.
We'll put that in the show notes.
Good stuff. Exciting. Oh, I don't want anyone to use it. I built it for me, I do want people to use it, but it's... that's the rubber hitting the road, I suppose, isn't it? When other people start jumping on board. Yeah.
So is there anything that you wanted to kind of share? A piece of advice that maybe something you've read in a book that helped you, or something your own therapy sessions have said that you found really kind of stuck with you?
That's quite a tough question. I think one of the things that I have realized in the course of some of this voluntary work that I'm doing at the moment to gain a bit of experience is that it can be very, very easy to become quite insular, especially if you're feeling depressed, for example, or it can be very easy to sort of be looking inwards, not in a selfish way, but just in a, you get very wrapped up in your own struggles or feelings, and it can be very hard to sort of realize that actually everyone is probably going through something. I know that sounds like a bit of a trite thing to say, but being part of that peer support group or working on that mental health support line, you kind of realize not that your own problems don't matter, but they're kind of interwoven. We're all struggling, and it's that whole thing of the human condition. And it can be quite easy to lose sight of that if you're able to, in whatever way, zoom out a tiny bit and kind of just realize I am struggling and that does matter, but there are other people who are struggling as well. And actually, even though it can be incredibly difficult to do, seeking out, support with other people that are going through similar sorts of things or even different things, but just, they're also struggling. It's almost like you can boil everything down to that feeling of life is hard sometimes. And it doesn't matter really how you got to that point or how you're even feeling about it. It's just that we're all struggling, and it can be probably quite easy for that to feel like something that negates your own sense of difficulty or struggle. But if you can do it in a way that doesn't do that, but like helps you to feel connected, that can be quite a healing thing in itself. Not everyone can afford to go and see a therapist. That's a relatively privileged thing to be able to do. And I am aware of that, but there are often groups around that can provide you with that kind of little feeling of connection, that which can really help to sort of lift you out of that feeling like everything is awful and it's all in me and there's nothing I can do about it. I don't know if that's useful advice, but I would say, if you are feeling along those lines and maybe therapy isn't an option for you, or you just don't feel ready for it, maybe seek out like a support group somewhere where you can feel just that little feeling of connection, those threads of connection with other people. It won't solve all your problems, but it will hopefully lift you just slightly out of yourself, just so that you can kind of see that there are other options out there.
Not feeling lonely or alone in something as well is always a good help. You might not be having the same problems like you say, but knowing that you're not the only one that feels not yourself is nice, because especially in the age of social media, seeing people post pictures where they're happy or they're traveling or they're, I don't know, they've had a baby or whatever it might be. And you looking in to that you're looking into a very small rectangle that does not paint the whole picture. I think like you say, zooming out, if you zoom out of that picture and you take in the whole world view of that person that you're looking at, not everything is 100%.
No.
So what makes you a happy dev?
I think I'll answer that with two answers. The first, on a purely development sort of point of view, I still get that little buzz that you get when you've been banging your head against a brick wall trying to get something to work and then it works.
Yeah.
Yes.
The adrenaline.
That's such a good feeling. And that hasn't gone. Like the idea, I will probably miss that if I stop doing this as a career at some point. Yeah. Like that feeling of just finally cracking something, or just that kind of light bulb moment where you go, got it. Okay. Now this works. That never gets old. But on a broader level, maybe I've just been very lucky, but I've just worked with some really, really lovely people. I'd start name checking, but I don't want to start forgetting anyone's. But I've worked with some people that I'm really fond of. And I think, I think that's what brings me most joy, is finding myself in a little team with people who just get along with each other. They want to do good work, but it's almost like the work is all kind of almost side benefit, almost like it's just nice building things with other people. And I think I think that's what probably makes me most happy in the job. And like I say, I've just been very fortunate to work with some really great people over the years. So yeah, nice. The people, there you go.
That's a good answer. I like that. Okay, well, that brings us to the end of episode 2 of series 2.
Thanks, James.
No worries. Thank you very much, John.